Welcome back. Good evening, everyone. This is Tribal Theocrat Live, and I'm Christian Gray. Today's February 16th, 2013. And we have a great show lined up for you tonight. I do want to say thanks to all the new followers on Twitter and Facebook. Our audience has literally multiplied in the last few weeks, no doubt in part because of the fine guests that we bring on here who bring fresh, thought-provoking material to the show. With a growing audience comes more haters, though, and I want to thank all of them, too, for their profoundly stupid comments and feedback. I was supposed to mention the 500th follower on Facebook, but I'm sorry, I forgot the name because we blew past that, and I can't go back that far, so I apologize for skipping the shout-out there. In just a moment, we'll bring on our guest to talk about the growing problem with our military and paramilitary establishment, but a few announcements about forthcoming shows first. Next Saturday is a bonus show, and we'll have Matt Parrott on to co-host with me, and we'll talk about current events, probably immigration problem, the Republican problem, and what kind of movement and leadership we really need to move forward. And then the following week, we'll have David Opperman on to discuss ethno-nationalism. So starting tonight, there are live shows 3 Saturdays in a row. And Robert Finkelfin has been on the show twice, and he's the only guest to have made a third appearance. And he's on tonight to talk about this growing problem of our police state. And many of you will probably be hearing some new things tonight on these matters, and for sure some will be offended. But we just ask you to think these things through. And if your view is we need police to protect us, or we should support the troops while opposing the wars, then you're probably in for a good treat tonight. And with that, we'll bring Robert on. Thanks for coming back, Robert.
You bet. I hope I bring a lot of haters with me, too.
I saw you have a couple on Facebook already.
Oh, yeah. Definitely there was a good one last night, Mr. Satanist Thelema advocate I saw.
It's amazing what kind of attractions we get.
But the haters make life interesting, so sometimes it's nice to have them around.
They do. It's good. It's good to have them around. Well, go ahead.
Just as a method of getting started, I was going to say, you know, hopefully tonight we can, you know, hit on the history of police, rethinking some areas about law and how big law leads to law enforcement, and you know, ending the war on drugs, talking about volunteer police. Just a few miscellaneous facts on cops, and then kind of start off with the problems with the military and standing armies inside of Christendom.
Sounds good. A lot of good material lined up. Perhaps we could hit one of the stories that came out last couple of weeks was the death of Chris Kyle, America's so-called best sniper. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I live here in North Texas, and so, you know, that happened not too terribly far from where I'm at. I think it happened in Erath County near Glen Rose, roughly in between Glen Rose and Stephenville. But there's really been an orgy since then nonstop of red state fascism, and it's kind of horrifying to me to see all my fellow Texans in it. But Chris Kyle wrote a book. It was called American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. And I read a good bit of a pirated copy of the book a man loaned me on PDF. I read that on New Year's Eve, and then, of course, this happened here just, you know, within about a month's time. But, you know, as I read through the book, I was, it was very poorly written. Let me just start off with that. Whoever the ghostwriter was, they didn't earn their pay. But it was just a completely calloused view towards human life and, you know, kind of a love of war and danger. It's an unusual attribute that you don't see too much in the circles we run in, but I do think there are those kinds of fanatical warrior types that do love war. But mainly it was his overall calloused attitude towards life, and I think there was a good bit of exaggeration that went on there, and particularly an incident that I know you've heard about, that where he alleges to have punched out Jesse Ventura in some bar that SEALs frequented in San Diego. Most likely, in my opinion, didn't happen. I'm not sure if there were at one time back when I read it, a few days after I read it, the book, there was a lot of good criticism in the comments on an Amazon.com entry for it. And I thought they'd called him out pretty well in a number of places. Unfortunately, now probably the number of comments has skyrocketed with memorials from various red state fascists. But it's very discouraging to see this kind of raw, open militarism, the embracing and worshiping of it going on. And we've kind of seen the emergence of the conservative movement into this very much a danger to us as much as a blue state socialist, of where the red state fascists are all in favor of anything that smacks of police or military. Something that I thought was a pretty good rebuke to him, Kyle in particular, and his chosen profession in life, was back in 2004, John Mueller, who was head of the National Security Studies at Ohio State, pointed out that the number of Americans killed in terrorist attacks was about the same as those who died from allergic reactions to peanuts, collisions with deer, and lightning strikes. And he also pointed out that Americans are 8 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than by a non-government employed terrorist. With non-government employed terrorist being the operative part of that sentence.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, you stayed on top of this whole recent kind of like Waco Part 2 affair out in California with the LAPD tracking down the that former cop there.
Yeah, I have been trying to keep on top of that, and I guess the official narrative now is that the police did not intentionally set fire to the building.
Even though the scanners say that, hey, let's burn it down.
Yeah. Well, Robert, you see, burn it down doesn't mean burn it down.
I was somewhat distressed to find out that they were referring to smoke grenades as burners. So now, to keep up with my full ghetto vocabulary, that, there's the original meaning of burner going back to the old 30s and 40s era detective novels where, burner was a handgun. Then it became to be with the blacks, it started pertaining to a throwaway cell phone or any kind of cell phone. And now I got to have, a third entry in my mind, burners for the smoke grenades.
Yeah.
Obviously, part of the smoke discharge mechanism produces an intense heat. And I think to some degree, if either sparks are open flame. But you wonder if it was just the fact that he went after those families, or the members of one of the cops' families, or if the LAPD was afraid that he was going to become more of a kind of a clarion call for reform or something, if he had
that's what I through. Think. That's where I tend to think. There was a good podcast today that came out on Lou Rockwell, where he interviewed William Grigg, and they talked about some of these things. And one of the things that I didn't know is that he had some hostages whom he let loose. Once I guess he had a calculated kill list, and he wasn't he wasn't killing everybody whole hog. He was specifically going after certain people, and so that changes the whole narrative of he was just a wild man. He had something he was doing and some message he was trying to give, and apparently they didn't want that message to come out. Now, I have no sympathy at all for murderers and killers like this guy, but I just want the other side to come out. Speaking of snipers, I've got this Amazon Prime subscription, which is cheaper than Netflix, and you get free access to some Prime movies, and I was wanting to check out some firearm stuff and found this series called Modern Sniper, and so I gave it a try, and I only got a few minutes into it because they just make no distinction between just war and unjust war, and if it's a target, let's kill it. I want to play this clip and get your thoughts on it real quick.
But there is one essential skill that the instructors cannot teach.
Bottom line is, will you pull the trigger when a time comes?
I mean, I have had to fire on people, and it's a very, me versus them. If it's not me, it's, or if it's not them, it's going to be me or my buddies.
And that's the hardest part of being a sniper is when the first time you crawl into your shooting position, you look through that optic and you see the individual you're about to reduce. And as long as you can maintain your objectivity and the overall big picture as to why you're doing what you're doing, you'll be fine.
Do I ever want to, do I ever plan on going out and killing somebody? No, I don't. But I can justify the fact that if I take this guy out or eliminate this target, then, possibly I've saved some lives.
Even if it's a... a man defending his family from invaders, right?
Right, exactly. The typical military, just I do what I'm told, and we got to follow orders type mentality. And you know, later on in the show, we'll get a little bit into, I'm hoping, into the first and second generation warfare mentality. Right. And I would contend pretty obviously that right now we're caught in the second generation of warfare, which just loves order. It very much wants to organize everything and relies on basically kind of an automaton type mentality. And due to our public schools and the churches the way they are, no one's really been taught to think kind of in a standalone ethical manner, that you go to church and know you get your relationship going on with Jesus, but you don't ever really sit down and think in terms of ethics. Should I do this? Should I not do this? It's basically once the government tells me to do something, it's okay. It's interesting with snipers that even as late as about 2005, there was an article or a letter in Soldier of Fortune magazine from, I believe it was just kind of the military occupational specialty code would have been 11B. I believe he was an Army infantryman. But he was kind of talking about how the breakdown was in the chow hall somewhere in Iraq. And that he was saying, you know, the snipers ate to themselves. They kind of stuck to themselves because there was a kind of a disgust and disliking of them, even amongst infantrymen, that they were considered sort of cold-blooded killers. And I don't really have anything against sniping in a righteous war, but you come and invade someone's country and then you know, consider someone who's defending their country to be a bad guy and worthy of taking out. These, you know, the Red State fascist, he thinks very much in terms of a slave mindset. He wants to be told what to do. And just a moment, I was got a message here. I was needing to speak up a little bit louder, if that might help things okay. A bit for the listeners. That the Red State fascist, he wants to be told what to do, and this very much applies to the enlisted man type personality. And I used to be an enlisted man myself, and I saw this quite frequently amongst particularly who were career military, that those who wanted to exercise more of their own judgment were, most of us got out within at the end of our first enlistment or shortly thereafterwards. Chris Kyle was in, I believe, for 10 or 11 years, and he only left the Navy because of problems in his marriage. And then the parts you just played from that program, these people obviously were, no kind of Christian understanding ever came into it. Like, oh, I've got a target, I've got to take him out. And you see this, unfortunately, too, amongst engineers or the physicists that, say, participate in the Manhattan Project. Oh, we've got to develop this monster bomb. Well, why? Well, I'm not really thinking about that. Just someone else told me to. And in America, we've had this top-down decision-making and order for a very long time. And after the war for Southern independence is lost, it took off through the roof. Yeah. So, I mean, I could go in a little bit more in depth. I mean, it sounds like a pretty reprehensible program. I've got a book, by the way, that I highly recommend to people. It's called The Ultimate Sniper, and it's written by a retired major. I can't remember what his name is, but the book's available through Paladin Press. And it gives you a lot of the in-depth information on sniping, but the man does not approach it from a moral or Christian ethical issue, but the technical information is there for those who want it. You know, movies that I thought kind of a little bit somewhat touched on the subject of sniping, but not from a serious theological discussion, was Enemy at the Gates that came out a few years ago, and it was directed from the pro-Soviet viewpoint and was set in Stalingrad during the battle for Stalingrad. And it involved predominantly a male Soviet sniper and a female, and then there was also a German sniper that came in towards the end of the show. But for people who, you know, may want to kind of understand a little bit more about sniping and how it was played out in the war, that would be a film to check out. That's Enemy at the Gates.
Sounds good. Speaking of cops, from that podcast I heard today on Lou Rockwell with William Gregg, they mentioned that cops in military, they teach deconsciousness. They teach their people to suppress asking those questions of right and wrong. So it's not surprising at all why some of them come home and they're going nuts. They have PTSD and they're not sure what to do. And I have great sympathy with people suffering from that. But it's horrible to have to go through several tours where you must suppress your those asking those ethical questions, and then you get home and your mind's just going nuts.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I do think there was an article I'd read recently, and I think it's very much true that many instances of post-traumatic stress disorder, I think you're dealing with people who are just consumed by guilt over what they have done. And, of course, it has ways of manifesting itself physically and emotionally as PTSD. But what I think they have to come to grips with is their guilt of the evil things they did. And, I mean, it certainly is a little bit of a bow out. They can say that, you know, due to half-assed parenting and the churches and public schools and the culture, that they were never given the ethical toolbox in which to look at these problems at. And that's true, but nevertheless, they did commit those deeds. And they're going to have to own up to the guilt, first of all, and then seek forgiveness. And outside of a Christian system, that starts becoming very hairy. Unfortunately, the Department of Veterans Affairs, which gets stuck actually, you know, counseling a lot of these people, their cure, of course, is to, one, to say, well, everything you did was fine. It was in a war waged by the U.S. government. And then they're going to try to treat the symptoms chemically, or biochemically, rather, by boosting neurotransmitter levels or suppressing other things. And it never really has the effect it's supposed to. So you have this, not to dwell on the Chris Kyle incident all night, but the man who killed him was a Marine who had whacked out and had a post-traumatic stress disorder and was under the care, I believe, of a psychiatrist at the Department of Veteran Affairs Hospital in Dallas. And what did it do? Well, it really didn't do much of anything for him. And the church, unfortunately, is unwilling to address these issues and to reclaim its proper role in counseling of people. That there's times to give hard advice to people, and unfortunately, the church, by and large, doesn't want to get it. And going back even further, the church still generally supports the war in Iraq and thinks it's a good thing.
They really do.
Which gets into Christian Zionism. We could go back to your first interview you did with Mickey Henry on that subject of Judaism and Jews. Yeah. And it's a huge, nasty mess we've gotten ourselves into.
It really is. And John McGregor had a really good section in his show he did with us about Zionism. So check out John McGregor's as well.
Yeah, it was good.
We talked about the LAPD. Did you hear about this recent Chicago Police Department news where they're actually refusing to respond to 911 calls?
Yeah, it's they'll no longer come right away to reports of things like criminal damage to property, vehicle thefts, garage burglaries, and burglaries. Obviously after the fact, but still, how do you know your house is really clear? This has happened already in Oakland, California. It's happened in Dallas to some degrees. And I think there's probably about 20 to 30 cities in the U.S. right now that have greatly curtailed their customer service, if you will, for responding to home issues. What's amazing is that they still maintain this. The cops at all cost want to maintain the patrol officer. And what we need right now is this good investigation. But they will not acquiesce to that. They want the large patrol force and trying to, scare away criminals by driving around. But mainly, I think it's so they can write traffic tickets and earn revenue for the city. And that way they can justify hiring more police, which means more promotions for the existing cops, more kingdoms for those in positions of authority. But it's becoming so apparent that what we need is good investigation and not cops that just drive around. I made this point on the first show, but I think it merits, or maybe in the second show, but it merits being made again, that with firemen, they don't drive around in their fire trucks looking for fires to put out or looking for to prevent fires. They just sit at the station, and when there's a call, they respond to it. Why not, I hate a lot of our law enforcement structure, but even going to that understanding would be vastly, vastly superior of where you basically did away with the patrol officer altogether, and if there was a bad car wreck or any of these crimes that take place, then they're dispatched and they go out to it. And it would be a huge money saver, and it would probably to some degree cut down on crime, although one problem, the recurring problem with police investigations is they tend to investigate those crimes that they deem it prudent to investigate. So if you're a city councilman or someone with power and wealth and there's a crime that is committed against you or your property, then it'll probably be investigated. If you're a Joe Sixpack and it's what they deem a small issue of maybe less than $5,000, then chances are they're not going to do a lot to investigate it.
Yep.
And this is where we need the power of competition. Competition is not a cure-all, as libertarians think, but it does limit the extent of man's sins. And going to some sort of competition in investigation, I think, would mitigate a lot of our problems.
Well, let's talk about cop history. A lot of people think that the growth of the police force was commensurate with the growth in crime. What do you know about that?
Anytime you mention this topic, particularly around pastors, they'll just say, well, Romans 13, we got to have cops. That's all there is to it. And, they don't realize that, well, really for a lot of our history, there have been no police at all. What I'm going to quote from here comes from one article predominantly called The Demand for Order and the Birth of Modern Policing. And it's from a publication called The Monthly Review. It's an independent socialist publication, December 2003, by Kristen Williams. And people balk and say, well, that's a socialist publication. Well, I try to get information from all over the place because you're not going to find, even amongst paleoconservatives, they are very loath to complain about the police too much. A lot of them have far too much luggage invested back from the 60s and 70s, like the John Birch Society did with their Support Your Local Police committees, and basically thought that your two sides of the coin were to be in favor of federalization of the police or to just devote to, to have the police independent. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the people that have done more serious work on the police issue have been from the liberal or the socialist side of the fence. But for those who want to read it, it's online. You don't even have to go to the original publication. It's pretty much everywhere. But it's called The Demand for Order and the Birth of Modern Policing by Kristen Williams. One of the first things they start out with in the article, though, is that there were a lot of riotous mobs in London in 1780, in the summer of that year. And eventually you would see a lot of the social unrest come to a full boil in the French Revolution. But the author goes on to say that the Metropolitan Police did not appear for nearly another 50 years until 1829. So you have riotous mobs, which is considered pretty much one of the worst problems you can have in any sort of urban environment, and yet you didn't have police for 50 more years after that. Public drunkenness was considered a serious problem in Boston as early as 1775, but the modern police force was not created there till 1838. But despite that, between 1820 and 1830, crime went down and continued to drop for the rest of the 19th century. And the city suffered only a single murder between 1822 and 1834. So before the establishment of the police in Boston, you're already seeing a clear line, 20-year history of crime going down. But yet the police force got established anyway. In Cleveland, in 1907, they decided to run an experiment called the Golden Rule Policy, in which they, rather arresting drunks or other public order offenders, the police would walk the drunks home or just issue a warning. In the year before the policy was established, they made a little over 30,000 arrests, but only 938 were for felonies. In the year after the Golden Rule was instituted, the police made 10,000 arrests, almost even 10,000, and about 1,000 of which were for felonies. So you saw the felony arrests stay about the same, 938 to 1,000. But the overall arrest rate dropped from 30,000 down to 10,000. That raises some serious questions to me, I think, about a lot of the standard mode of operations for law enforcement. Another issue with Boston was that kind of reflective of the post-Puritan values, which by 1800, New England was considered fairly universally Unitarian, but some of the poison in the Puritan movement lived on. Boston's laws prohibited only habitual drunkenness, but in 1835, public drunkenness was also banned. Alcohol arrests increased from a few hundred each year to several thousand. In 1878, police powers were extended even further as they were authorized to arrest people for loitering and using profanity. I think you're seeing a gradual increase in what has been considered crimes, as well as the amount of levity, not levity, but leeway shown people that to guarantee the or justify the presence of the police. One that I really liked in particular was talking about how sovereign states going back in Europe many centuries, that European kingdoms in the Middle Ages became law states before they became police states, meaning that they made laws and adjudicated claims before they established an independent mechanism for enforcing them. Organized police powers arose specifically when traditional, informal, or community-maintained means of social control broke down. So there were other means of having social control. And lastly, from that article, there were a couple other points made about New York City, talking about the night watch, and you know, I've mentioned the night watch the last time I was on, where it was basically just a private citizen or citizens hired by the members of the central business district or any business community for that matter, and they weren't full time law enforcement officials, but they had just the basic kind of police powers that everyone had. But it was saying here about the part of New York City that the their chief at the time was named Mastel, who was, I believe, in office during the 1850s and 1860s. But he helped he promoted a public panic over public disorder, and in part to quiet criticism of the new police. I mean, this is stuff we hear now all the time, but it's been going on for 150 years. More subtly, the very existence of the police may have suggested the possibility of urban peace and made it seem feasible that most laws would be enforced, and here's the big part of the sentence, not indirectly by the citizenry, but directly by the state.
Yeah.
So there have been mechanisms and means of enforcing those laws that need to be enforced. Going back to your last interview with Mickey Henry with the topic of the Kinsman Redeemer, a subject in Christian theology that is all but forgotten today, and really it was forgotten until the time Rush Dooney wrote Institutes of Biblical Law, that it was just a part of the Old Testament that was just glossed over and no one thought about it. But when you start looking at the doctrine of the Kinsman Redeemer, you think, well, wow, I mean, this would go a long ways towards limiting the power of the God state, and it does a lot to increase the power of the family.
Yeah, I posted an article on Facebook where I believe it was a Hispanic man, a Mexican man in Texas, was with his two boys, and his two young boys were pushing the car. Maybe they were out of gas or something. I'm not sure the details, but they were pushing the car, and they were hit by a drunk driver and killed both of the boys. And the dad takes care of business and goes over and shoots the guy who killed his sons, and now the dad's being charged with homicide.
Yeah, whereas the drunk driver probably at best might have done a couple of years in prison, and very likely might have just gotten off of probation.
Yeah, and to think that father would be one of the persons paying for that guy's probably attorney and jail sentence and all that.
Oh, I know it's an outrage. I think to me that's a good, excellent example though of the Kinsman Redeemer in action. And you think of all the people whose lives have been lost over the years over drunk driving, and that I think in large part due to the fact that some of the worst offenders of drunk driving laws are lawyers and policemen themselves, that I think there's a kind of a tendency to not want to have this be a heavy criminal action. And to some ways it is a hard issue to prove in a totally objective scientific sense of what blood alcohol levels should constitute criminality. Well, I can imagine the Mexican man went back to the car, found the man probably reeked of alcohol and was incoherent, and that was a good enough test right there. And trying to determine some of those things objectively in a court environment would be too difficult to ever establish the guilt. And so it's I think there's very much a need for kind of a subjective ability to make judgments but where we can't necessarily pin it down. I'm reminded of a comment that Potter Stewart, who's a Supreme Court justice, made about obscenity, where he said, well, it's hard to define, but I know it when I see it. And if you think about trying to define obscenity, you could write many, many pages of the different areas and trying to draw lines of like, well, okay, well, this is okay, well, this goes too far. But where he knows it when he sees it. And I think we need to rethink a lot of our law code because we've become, well, just the whole issue of big law, small law, which I'd like to get into next.
Sure. Yeah, we may as well talk about law since we're the term they go by now is hardly police officer anymore, but law enforcement officer. What do we need to do in terms of rethinking law?
If people that may wonder, well, why the law issue, and then they may even think, well, okay, well, the problem with lawyers are the issue with lawyers is a big one, and yes, it's very problematic, but there's an overall trend in American society for over-specialization, and so if we're going to have over-specialization in the field of law, then we're also going to have it in the area of the peace officer, and of course, they're really not peace officers anymore, they're law enforcement officers. Well, a law needs to be something, you know, it's an extension of ethics, basically, of that the what would be considered unethical in the criminal realm would be what most of our law would be focused on, although obviously we would have civil law that would only result perhaps in lawsuits. But still, law should be something that can be basically understood by everyone. Without having a law degree or any sort of legal, large number of years spent in legal training. There's a quote. Well, let me just outline before I give the quote, but currently I would say America's legal system right now is based on a small law, Talmudic approach that has been further shaped by the pitfalls of Protestant and Roman Catholic view of law. Now, I say small law. I'm borrowing this from a writer named Dale Alquist, who wrote a book called Chesterton's Uncommonly Sensible Views on the Law, and that's G.K. Chesterton he's referring to. But what he said was, the problem nowadays, however, is that most legislation tries to deal with all the exceptions. This is why so many laws defy common sense. The rule itself is lost, and we have nothing left but a welter of exceptions. It is the triumph of small laws over big laws. So take, for instance, like, say, this would be an example of big law. Be considerate of your neighbors. You know, the golden rule, and you could just take biblical property rights into that too, but that would be a very simple view. With the small law approach, we start having technicians coming out with sound meters and trying to establish, well, how many decibels is this before it's too loud, or they start riding up like, okay, well, you're allowed to have this much trash in your yard. Or then they forget, oh, crap, Mexicans love painting their houses purple. You know, well, that's terrible. That, you know, well, what is really purple? And then so they end up having to put into the law code, you know, all these different color shades that you can't, you know, paint your house. And pretty soon you have just a listing of just city laws. It would be 10,000, 15,000 pages. And, you know, ignorance of the law is what's considered no excuse. It always seems to work in favor of the criminal element. You know, the Ten Commandments, to me, are the best example of the big law approach. Then that most of the case laws in the Old Testament are something of an outworking of those Ten Commandments. I mean, granted, there's additional details provided, but if, you know, if a person could remember the Ten Commandments and take that and merge it with the Beatitudes from the Book of Matthew, that they would have kind of a pretty good way how to live their life. But anyway, when I say, you know, the small law Talmudic approach, and the Talmudic approach is very much one of having many, many, many entries, but always allowing yourself loopholes to get through if you're a practitioner of law. And then, unfortunately, I'll get into a little bit more detail here later, but the Protestant and the Roman Catholic view, unfortunately, has not been a big help in this area. There's another quote. It's kind of lengthy, and I may end up cutting it down a little bit, but it's from Alexander Solzhenitsyn that goes very much along with that extract from the book by Chesterton, and it's from his 1978 commencement speech that he gave to at Harvard University, which is kind of considered one of Solzhenitsyn's classics. But I'll probably come here for air in a few seconds to catch my breath. But he says that life organized legalistically has thus shown its inability to defend itself against the corrosion of evil. I mean, that's certainly true in the United States. Western thinking has become conservative. The world situation should stay as it is at any cost. There should be no changes. The debilitating dream of a status quo is a symptom of a society which has come to the end of its development. And when I start talking about second generation warfare here shortly, I'll get into that problem as well too, of the kind of a stagnant situation that's set in. People in the West have acquired considerable skill in using, interpreting, and manipulating law, even though laws tend to be too complicated for an average person to understand without the help. Losing my place here, just a moment. Without the help of an expert, any conflict is solved according to the letter of the law and is thus considered to be a supreme solution. If one is right from a legal point of view, nothing more is required. Nobody may mention that one could still be not entirely right and urge self-restraint, a willingness to renounce such legal rights, sacrifice, and selfless risk. It would sound simply absurd. One almost never sees voluntary self-restraint. Everyone operates at the extreme limit of those legal frames. An oil company is legally blameless when it purchases an invention of a new type of energy in order to prevent its use. A food product manufacturer is legally blameless when he poisons his product to make it last longer. After all, people are free to not buy it. And you see that all across American supermarkets with the poisoned seed starting with Monsanto and propagating from there. And the libertarians, unfortunately, are many of those who would say, well, you're free not to buy it. But in many instances, without going to extreme difficulty, what are my alternatives of where, you know, our food supply has been completely corrupted by this? Solzhenitsyn went on to say, I've spent all my life under a communist regime, and I will tell you that a society without any objective legal code is a terrible one indeed. But a society with no other scale but the legal one is not quite worthy of man either. A society which is based on the letter of the law and never reaches any higher is taking very scarce advantage of the high level of human possibilities. The letter of the law is too cold and formal to have a beneficial influence on society. Whenever the tissue of life is woven of legalistic relations, there is an atmosphere of moral mediocrity paralyzing man's noblest impulses. And it will be simply impossible to stand through the trials of this threatening century with only the support of a legalistic structure. I know Solzhenitsyn was Eastern Orthodox, but I mean, to me, that was Rushdoony-esque type quality insight there. And it defines so much of the problem of our age. You can even see it in smaller issues like biblicism. Your prior guest, Tom Hingist, made a good point, I thought. And Mr. Hingist is a theonomist, but he was just talking about horse thieves and how following a super strict version of theonomy would have not really been enough of an impediment to horse thievery, because in the West, if you didn't have your horse, well, there were so many things you could not do. You might even die from the inability to get around. And I do think a good case can be made, just as he made, that for hanging horse thieves, even though a super strict, kind of legalistic version of the theonomic structure would not support this. Now, I don't want to go, you know, totally carte blanche with the Old Testament text, but I think a super strict view of theonomy can lend itself to small law thinking and kind of undermining ultimately what the purpose of Old Testament law is. And, of course, certainly the Jews with their Talmud, they've departed so far from that to where they now are basically Satanist, although the basic Christians think, oh, well, they're the Old Testament religion. Pardon me one second.
The synagogue of Satan.
Pretty much. And unfortunately, the evangelicals in particular seem to be totally enraptured by it. I wish that there was a better Christian tradition on law, and we actually did have something that was, you know, halfway acceptable through the era of common law. I mean, it was a bit too, I think, you know, influenced and created by natural law. But now we've pretty much entirely lost that tradition. Roman Catholics now, they kind of aid the Talmudic understanding in the public sphere through their issue of papal infallibility. You know, when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, which is only every once in a while, but when he does, this is considered to be a new revelation. And that's how the rabbis are with their Talmud. That with the Talmud, it's rabbis writing basically what they're considered new revelation. So it's kind of hard to have a fixed idea on law amongst Catholics when they can add to it anytime they want to via a papal decree. And Catholic canon law, too, gets to be rather convoluted. And you and I both know traditional Catholics, and you know what happens when you start pointing out problems with their popes. I mean, actually, if you knew this canon law, well, exactly. You know, he's justified on that, or if you understood Sanctum and Torum, written in 1375, then he is wrong on that point. And, you know, goodness gracious, you have to be an expert in canon law just to understand a lot of the outward particulars of the Catholic Church. And that doesn't even cover the basic theology. Roman Catholicism, too, via the scholastics, Thomas Aquinas being the most well-known of the scholastics, they, when they were creating natural law, they gave it this really Hellenistic type flavor of where neutrality was allowed, and it was assumed that the natural, unregenerate man could reason his way to this kind of understanding of a law code. And unfortunately, most of the Catholic Church natural law theorists, and this has continued to this day, you have explicit biblical understanding on some topic, or at least something that appears to be a very strong suggestion, natural law theorists tend to ignore it and gloss over it entirely. With the Catholic Church, I understand this in that they want to be their own lawgiver because, you know, the tradition and the church, the church power in their system basically is superior to Scripture. But, you know, Protestants pretty much fall into the same problem. Protestant legal education is basically modeled on the same Talmudic and Catholic law system. So until Rush Dooney came along, there was... I'm supposed to tell you that the sound just went out.
Huh. Too bad for them, huh? They can't hear it?
Can you hear it now? Okay, it came back in.
Oh.
Well, good.
It must be the cops.
Yeah, probably so. They're getting pissed off. With Protestantism, if you take, like, you know, look at, like, Baylor University, which is a Baptist college here in Texas, but their overall philosophical framework for law is not really any different than what you would expect at, say, the law school at Notre Dame or Notre Dame, or at some Jewish college. If anything, you know, the Jewish college is much more consistent. Until Rush Dooney came along, and there was another writer as well, an Episcopalian who resided in Houston, who wrote a book, I think, called God's Law Today or God's Law in the World Today. There really had not been much emphasis on developing a distinctly biblical view of law since the Puritans were actually still Orthodox in New England. Now the Protestant view on law pretty much is basically kind of an ex nihilo view of it, that the legislature gets together and they create it, and whatever's there is good. And, you know, Romans 13 says that, you know, no matter what's passed, it'll be a terror to evildoers. So it's kind of depressing, and unfortunately, I'd say, you know, Protestants at this point are on the bottom end of things in terms of law, and it shows in the Supreme Court, in that we've got what are considered, I think, six nominal Catholics and three Jews that sit on the court. Of course, there is the issue of Sotomayor of you know, is she a crypto Jew or not? From the, I'm trying to think what Jewish tradition there. Some people think she's from. It doesn't matter. Not the Ashkenazic one.
Even Scalia's got his assistant. Last I heard was a Talmudic Jew.
Whose assistant?
Scalia, Justice Scalia.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So he may not be a Jew himself, but it's just like you have a president who's a Gentile, but their chief of staffs are always Hebes.
Well, you know, Scalia, too, where he was involved in hearing some case, I think, involving Halliburton, and he was down in Mississippi hunting with Dick Cheney at the time that this case was up for review. And it's just a gross violation of the judicial canon of ethics. And, of course, the court ruled in favor of Halliburton. And this is, you know, our arch-Catholic on the Supreme Court. And it doesn't work out too well.
It's a joke.
We still have, you know, I believe America is certainly a plurality of Protestants, and I think it's probably still a majority of Protestants, yet we don't have one representative in the Supreme Court. And I think that's a clarion call that Protestants really need to heavily rethink their view on the law. If we had kind of a view of law which the average everyday man could understand, I think this would go a long, long ways towards reducing the power of law enforcement, where we don't need these. There's a view, and it's incorrect, but that somehow, you know, cops are trained enough in the law to where they can be its basic enforcers. And we've seen time and time again that they really don't know squat about the law. How many open carry, if you've been on open carry forums, and I know you have, but where a cop will try to arrest someone or tell him he's violating the law, and the man who's open carrying, no, I'm most certainly am not violating the law. This has been seen repeatedly in any number of fields, and it's in part an indictment of the law system, but it also makes the policemen so much more dangerous because they themselves don't know what the law is. They don't really care in a lot of ways. But if we could if we knew what the law was, we could neuter law enforcement because there would be less of an issue of enforcing the law because it's easier to understand. And I don't know if, you know, amongst theonomists, I've really not seen much of a drive towards more of the big law approach that a lot of them tend to have this habit, unfortunately, of baptizing Republican politicians and all their policies and saying, oh, well, that's biblical. Oh, we're going to be Calvinists. We're going to have, you know, a theonomic Congress in Washington. It's a preposterous idea. I don't know how it's supposed to work. The theonomic, you know, the way the theonomic movement has fallen out has been kind of, it's been pretty disappointing. I would say as a couple of quick points in terms of big law and small law, is that if you want, you can reduce all traffic laws to one basic concept. Don't drive recklessly. But the Talmudists make the roads more unsafe through their small law approach to traffic regulations. For homeowners, the basic law, big law, is respect your neighbor and his property. But once again, the Talmudists have made property ownership this, you know, Byzantine maze of regulations of what you can and cannot do. You know, the Ayn Rand approach of just complete laissez-faire, do ever what you want to, turn your house into a brothel, is as wrong of an approach as the unbending homeowner associations who get irate that someone changes their oil in their own driveway. one last point I'd like to make on this before moving on to the next major topic is that I think the way a lot of our pro-life understanding is based, which comes mainly from Catholic theology, it's led to a small law mentality in fighting abortion, of where pro-lifers will go in and lobby to try to have all these different zoning rules put into act, or different health inspections put into act. And I think where it's heading now, unfortunately, is that you're seeing particularly a lot of those of the Catholic background in particular, but these consistent pro-lifers who believe that they are opposed to the death penalty. Now you're seeing the Vatican and the Catholic Church coming out in favor of gun control, backing Obama's anti-gun schemes, in favor of spending exorbitant sums of money on anything that has the potential just to save even one life, such as security guards at public schools. And, of course, those tax dollars that are used to pay for security guards at public schools. Well, that's money that's not spent on maintaining the roads. So when there's a rainstorm and someone hydroplanes across a bad road that maybe could have otherwise been built, well, then that person gets killed. I think there's an idolatry of human life in the Catholic pro-life mentality that really needs to be addressed. And I think there needs to be two kind of the quick way to break that apart is to distinguish between anti-abortion and pro-life. I would say I'm definitely anti-abortion, but on the pro-life issue, pretty quickly you start running into the whole issue of consistent pro-life versus inconsistent pro-life position. I would definitely be an inconsistent pro-life advocate, since I do believe in the death penalty and the ability to use deadly force to protect oneself. But the small law, big law approach, it waters down, it comes down through, it propagates through all of our theology.
Good points. There's been a lot of sheriffs and local law enforcement recently saying that they're not going to enforce any federal laws, any gun confiscations and so forth. But one area in which they're compromised is this issue of the war on drugs, because at the federal level, they receive funding from the feds and assistance from federal agencies to fight this, in my view, bogus war on drugs. What are your thoughts about one of the main sources of revenue for cops, this war on drugs they fight?
To me, the the Oath Keepers, like some of the sheriffs you were mentioning earlier, I find it highly incredulous that we're supposed to believe that they'll support the Constitution and the Second Amendment, where they violate numerous aspects of the Constitution or just Christian theology in their drug war. My basic view overall on drugs is that people should be free to manufacture, own, or buy drugs. The only thing I would like to see that some way, halfway along what we have right now, is to see kind of a where local towns would be able to stop open distribution with the intent to get high, but where pharmacies could sell any drug they wanted to anyone, but hopefully with the understanding that they wouldn't become like a liquor store for drugs. But other than that, people could order any kind of drug they wanted to and sell it out of their house, sell it at parties or whatnot. I would hope, as a Christian, that they would not do that. But the war on the drug problem has been far eclipsed by the problem of the war on drugs. We had kind of a dress rehearsal to the war on drugs and what happened with alcohol prohibition when it was passed, I believe, in 1919. Does that sound right? That it was, of course, a very bloody time and where a lot of our organized crime was firmly established, from bootlegging and running bars at that time. And this was actually kind of ironic, too, in that women got the right to vote. I can't remember if that was the 18th Amendment. I believe it was in the 19th Amendment, I think, was the Prohibition Amendment. But this was kind of the first major piece of legislation that the gynocracy had been lobbying for, was alcohol prohibition, that they were going to make men perfect and make them come home and be good, compliant husbands. And it didn't happen. It led to this complete disaster. But yet we're completely duplicating the efforts of prohibition, alcohol prohibition, with drug prohibition. The one thing we're not duplicating is that we didn't call it quits. And I believe the 19th Amendment was receded in 1933 or 34, I believe. So it ran for about 15 years. Richard Nixon established the Drug Enforcement Agency in about 1970 or 71. And it was actually a problem with law enforcement prior to that. The Central Intelligence Agency, established as a source of raising funds for covert operations, they established in the Golden Triangle area of Burma and Thailand, and I believe Cambodia and Laos were also considered part of the Golden Triangle. But the means of acquiring heroin from there and would resell to fund some black project that they did not want any sort of congressional oversight or acknowledgement of. So the war on drugs, it goes back, I mean, I would say probably fairly easily 50 years in a major way, or at least 40 years. And of course, the huge black market profit is one of the things that drives a lot of the Central Intelligence Agency's wickedness. A lot of their off-budget programs are funded from the lack of scarcity on the drugs and how they're willing to step up to the plate to push them. There's a book written by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. He's a journalist with one of the UK newspapers, the Independent, I believe. But it was called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. And he was in, I believe, their Washington Bureau back in the 90s when Clinton was in office. And there were several good chapters in there just detailing. One was about the operation at MENA, which was bringing in drugs that way, but as well as law enforcement's substantial presence in drug running in Arkansas. And this pretty much goes on in any state, but we know more about it in Arkansas in part due to, you know, books like his because of the problem of Clinton. You know, the war on drugs creates a lot of problems. Once again, by making drugs more scarce, the price goes up. So you'll see more people that fall into prostitution, more thefts, more assaults, burglaries. And people do that to raise the money to buy drugs. It's an absolute level of insanity that to me is fueled in part kind of by the old Puritan and the part of the thinking from the French Revolution. I'm trying to think of the Jacobins.
Yep, Jacobins.
Of where they could come in and they could control human behavior to a very small degree, and obviously biblical law, we do believe in controlling human behavior to some degrees, but there is really no provision under the Old Testament law for trying to control the drugs people get access to. And certainly if they crash their car into two little kids while they're high,
yeah,
they should be, you know, given the just punishment for that. But other than that, it starts to be a problem of personal choice, and that and it's had huge repercussions on that. Kind of like the Old Testament laws on false religions, that we are not to allow the public practice or evangelization for a false religion. But if someone wants to believe in a false religion in their home and we don't know about it,
sure,
then, you know, we're not to do anything about it. We're not to establish a you know, kind of a 1984 society where we got cameras in everybody's house to make sure that they're not practicing Judaism. Although at this point, I might actually have to rethink that that point. But I mean, seriously though, that's part of the Old Testament law's brilliance in that it prevents the police state that we're seeing forming now, because it limits what the civil magistrate can do in order to try and to create a just society. But a lot of it has to be done by individuals and families and organizations, shunning and punishing people in other ways.
The proof is really in the pudding with this drug war thing. I think over $5.2 billion have been spent, taxpayer dollars, this year already on the war on drugs. And I believe the last stat I heard about the last 40 years was well over $1 trillion has been spent of my money and your money. And the addiction rate is still as high as it's ever been, if not higher. It's absolutely pathetic. I think over 100,000 people already this year have been arrested for the victimless crime of smoking weed. It's really an outrageous waste of resources.
I'm not sure what year you graduated from high school, but I graduated in the latter part of the 1980s. And, you know, of course, Nancy Reagan had her big, I think it was the DARE campaign, you know, dare to not use drugs. But I can tell you, in the small town I was from, I could get anything. LSD, heroin, cocaine, marijuana. It was all just, you know, I knew the people to go to talk to those things if I wanted it.
Yeah, you can't outlaw that.
And, you know, this is a small town. What's it going to be like in a city like Dallas, yeah, or Houston? It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible waste. And, law enforcement loves it, though, because it, a large part of the people that are hired work in narcotics, or they work for the Drug Enforcement Agency or various state-level narcotics boards or control boards. And the law enforcement very much likes it. They like the ability to confiscate property that belongs to people who have either been accused of using drugs or peddling drugs, because that enriches their coffers as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that really hurts non-normal or luxury drug users are people who need drugs for different medical ailments. Obviously, the cannabis plant has been considered to have high potentiality for fighting certain types of cancers. LSD has the potential to help people with cluster headaches, a very bad position.
Yeah.
And then cocaine and heroin both have much higher pain-fighting abilities than morphine or Ativan or normal pain fighters. But the Drug Enforcement Agency comes through and says, well, these are Schedule I drugs that have no medicinal properties. Well, why don't you let me be the decider of what is medicinal or not?
Precisely.
Even the smaller things, like just about anything is considered to be within the realm of helping helps the drug dealers. So like iodine, potassium and iodine, which people with certain types of thyroid disorders will use to replenish their iodine. Well, I believe now it's to the point where you can only buy one bottle of 5% iodine, potassium iodine mixture again, per month, because otherwise you're suspected of being a meth producer. Also as well, syringes and IV needles, which used to normal people could buy those for injecting themselves with vitamin D, vitamin B12. Now they cannot get those. Those are considered prescription items as well. And you've seen kind of an unholy alliance form with the medical industry, because doctors love this. It sends more people to them for prescriptions for things.
Sure it does. Anna,
it just enriches their pocket.
Anna from the chat room says that she had a coworker who swore that marijuana was the only thing that helped her migraine headaches when no heavy prescription drugs did. And, of course, she got fired when she had to give a drug test.
Of course. I mean, that's very unjust firing. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that, you know, those who start using pain-killing drugs like morphine, let's say it's legal and you have a prescription for it, that when people have a lot of pain, that they do not develop an addiction to those things when it's used to fight pain. Or if they do, it's a very low-level addiction when they're not using it as a recreational drug user.
Yeah.
So tell your friend Anna to see if she can get some LSD. That might help her migraines.
There you go, Anna.
Unfortunately, LSD is a very complex to manufacture chemically, whereas cannabis products are, you know, once you harvest them, it's pretty well straightforward how to use them.
Let's move on here to a different subtopic. This is Tribal Theocrat Live. Guest is Robert Fingolfin talking about the police state. Robert, last couple times you were here, one of the shows you mentioned a different model of law enforcement would be volunteer policing for crime prevention. Talk about that if you can.
No, I'd say volunteer policing starts with the individual and includes private security, volunteer posses, private investigators, and militias. With the individual, the most obvious instance, whether it be a person who goes concealed carry or open carry of firearms, if they, many of us who do that, we've taken on the burden and do so gladly of trying to provide some degree of safety to the public. And that's the basic building block. And from there, with, say, like a posse, well, if you have multiple people, you can handle things the individual can't, say, such as a hostage situation at a bank, or private investigators, people who are very good at running down problems that need to be solved. You know, I don't have that skill set, but there are people that do. And then for really big things, say militias, that if you were dealing with, say, a motorcycle gang, you know, Hell's Angels, maybe they and a couple other gangs want to converge on the county you live in, and it might be enough people that were even the posse, if you had a 15 or 20 member posse, says, hey, we need more people than this, that they would, you know, call out the militia. But to avoid a police state, it's always going to be difficult to prove anything in a court by biblical standards of evidence, because we don't want the court to have too much power. So I'd say in a Christian system, we should be focused first and foremost on crime prevention. No, focus on prevention. Where we want the investigative ability to handle a crime after the fact, we would generally like to try to prevent it. And as you have more people who are engaged in concealed carry and open carry, I think you will see a decline in the numbers of crime itself. passive prevention of crime, such as, you know, locks on doors, I mean, hey, that's fine. That's a starting place. But we need active prevention, too, such as more gun ownership, more carrying of guns out in public, neighborhood patrols, and the ability to discriminate when it comes to people that live around us. You know, if we could allow people into our neighborhoods who we consider to be good neighbors, then that would do a lot to lower crime down. But, you know, the Civil Rights Act kind of took that from us. In Texas, as in most places around the country, the merchants used to hire a night watchman to look after their stores after hours. And I think I mentioned this the last time I was on, but my father worked as a night watchman around 1960 in the small town of Groveton, Texas. Had about 1,100 people at the time. And he carried a handgun only, despite having no professional law enforcement training. And there were several men who took on night watchman duty, and they were paid by the business owners in the downtown region. Unfortunately, the merchants in most areas were very glad to see the establishment of police departments, because then they could spread out that cost of protection of their stores to the whole town at large. And you've seen this repeatedly with, you know, the business interest in this country, of where they've had to create these unholy alliances with governments. But the night watchman, one reason I mention is that, okay, well, here in 1960, it was still being used in Groveton, Texas. In another town I lived in, it existed up until the late 1960s. So we're, you know, not even 50 years removed yet of having some towns with having night watchmen. So this isn't some arcane idea from the 1700s, although many arcane ideas are quite good. Private security, that already exists. There's private patrol services even exist. In North Texas, particularly in a part of Irving called Las Colinas, there's the Las Colinas Association. And they have, I think, 5 or 6 patrol vehicles in their organization, and they provide an added degree of security. And if you were to get rid of most law enforcement, I think you would see the rising up of these kinds of businesses for those people and organizations that wanted, you know, an extra level of security. And you already do see alarm services that will send people out if an alarm is activated. So, you know, a lot of these structures exist already for dealing with the replacement of police. It's not like we have to sit around and think, oh, gosh, what could we do if the police weren't there? Well, you know, just look to the past and look to what we have now. It already exists. One of the biggest indictments to me of those that say the voluntary system can't exist, obviously, would be volunteer fire departments. But going beyond that, in Central Park in New York City, they rely on a volunteer ambulance service, and they even have a nice ambulance and everything that's used for a park that's frequented by tens of thousands of people each day. Now, if you can have a volunteer ambulance service that will function in the most statist oppressive city in the U.S., it kind of tells me it can probably work anywhere. So we have right now a proven track record not only of volunteer fire departments, but also, in the lesser degree, volunteer ambulance services, and we just need to step that up more. The Central Park, the volunteer ambulance there, it's generally staffed by EMTs and paramedics, but people who volunteer their time. So they have people who agree to be on call as a way to a service to their community. And people that don't have the ability to service their community or their church, it creates a lot of problems in our society. A good thing with any sort of posse, which, by the way, I would say would include you know, men and volunteers who pursue the issue of defense on a more in-depth basis than just the open carry, concealed carry guy, that you would probably have at least one or two snipers for the, you know, a potential hostage situation. But a volunteer posse is not going to be interested in enforcing drug laws or laws that are used to justify the existence of the current police in any way. They're not going to be looking to set up speed traps like, hey, I'm not getting paid for this.
That's right.
You know, yet you want me to jack up some guy who out of his house sells drugs in an Amway type fashion? You know, no way. That you have a completely different dynamic there, that the volunteer posse man is trying to find a way to do less work, whereas the full-time law enforcement is trying to find a way to justify their job. Another thing that you know, cops law, they love to show up to minor fender benders. Well, of course, less so now than in the past, but they will very frequently, you know, of course, bring fire departments along. And I think that's one way full-time fire departments try to justify their existence, is that, well, we went out on all these calls. Okay, well, how many calls were actually, you know, fires? Maybe one-tenth of them or so. Another thing that cops are used very frequently for is for to help wives evict their husbands out of the house, which is kind of a favorite pastime of police at this point. Cops know that women support them by a much higher margin than men do, and so the policeman will almost always take the side of the wife that, you know, she says, oh, well, he's abusing me. Well, then once the man is evicted and charged with abuse, he's almost always going to lose the divorce settlement. So, you know, pastors, or cops are rather, are like pastors in that they know women are their biggest supporters, and they're always side with them to try to keep them happy. I think a volunteer posse would probably say, if a call like that came, is your life in any real danger? And if she said, well, yes, it is, and there was no sign of it, well, then, you know, she could be dealt with for bearing false witness. If she said, well, no, my life isn't in danger, well, you know, go talk to an elder of a church or talk to a neighbor that knows something. We're not a marital service. Now, I hate to beat this too much to death, but there was a neighbor that was two doors down from where I live at, and it was a hideous mixed-race couple of an Israeli Jew and an Indian woman, and they had these these hideous mixed-race kids,
oh,
and they walk around the neighborhood wearing these skull caps of these special designer type skull caps. But he liked to yell at her a lot. But she was always calling the cops on him. So one or two squad cars would show up where I lived at very frequently, and they would go down and talk to him and diffuse the situation. This would go on an hour or so. So you have cops being used as a, you know, kind of as a marital counseling service. And when it comes down to actual, honest to God, criminal crime fighting, I doubt it very much of it goes on. Pardon me for one moment.
No, go ahead. Yeah, I don't think they do very much actual crime fighting,
except maybe accidentally shooting drug dealers and things like that.
Accidentally mistaking a 71-year-old Mexican girl for a big, large black guy.
How many rounds did they fire into that truck? Was it 31 or 40?
That thing was riddled with rounds, and they shot her twice in the back.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll make a less than complete recovery, too.
Yeah, and the vehicle was the wrong vehicle. It didn't even match the description. And even if it did match the description, you're supposed to give the guy a chance to surrender rather than start flinging bullets downrange.
And it being Los Angeles, where there's like 10 million people that live, you know, there were probably, you know, 20 vehicles that matched the description. That was a good, to me, it illustrates kind of the paranoid insanity of a policeman, of where they just lost their mind over that whole affair of how many homes did they illegally search, about 400?
Yeah, they did. They searched, and it turns out the guy for a large part of the hunt was a couple hundred yards down the street from where they were setting up base, their command. He was hiding out in one of the houses they forgot to check. I did a podcast a week ago or so about cops and stuff, and I mentioned a story where they shot the wrong guy, and the SWAT team comes in, and they flung something like 70 or 80 rounds just on one guy, and they only hit about 22 of 70. I forget the ratio, but it was a lousy hit percentage. And who knows how many bullets went where?
Maybe cops aren't the gun experts and marksmen that we're led to believe that they are.
Clearly not.
Yeah, I remember there was an incident here in Dallas a few years ago. A black cop shot himself in the leg with a Glock handgun. You know, for those that are familiar with the trigger on a Glock handgun, you know, how do you accidentally shoot yourself?
Yeah, right? Yeah. There's you have to actually pull the trigger all the way back.
Right. Right.
Right. Well, did you want to talk about finish this up or move on to the next subject?
Let's go and move on.
Yeah, I wanted to pick your brain on the whole issue of generation warfare, fourth, second, third. Can you get us into fourth generation warfare?
Well, and people might say, well, why talk about this? This isn't an issue of warfare. Well, it, actually, that whole system has a lot of implications in a different number of areas. Right now, I would say the if you want to, well, a lot of the crime wave we see in our country, say, like, take Chicago, since that's been a rather violent area of late, that would be an example of a fourth-generation warfare forces. And what really defines fourth-generation warfare is at least one party is a non-state army, say, like Hezbollah in southern Lebanon when they were fighting the Israelis in 2006, that you had a second-generation force, the Israelis fighting a fourth-generation force. And almost everywhere where you have fourth-generation forces at work, they're winning, and the established state system is losing. Maybe in the very long haul, like with the Vietnam War, the Vietnamese lost almost all the battles or a lot of the battles they fought, but they won the war. And the only battle that really matters in a war is the last one. And the crime forces in this country are, they're winning right now, particularly in areas where you're dealing with black or Mexican crime. But they're winning. And I think this discussion of the different generations of warfare really does fit in quite pertinently with that. The first generation of warfare was column and line type movements that you would see, like, say, during the American War for Independence, where people would line up and kill one another, and it was very much a system focused on order. It was a fervent system, a culture of order. Second generation of warfare, there's some disagreement of when it came into being. Some might say during the War for Southern Independence. Others would say during World War One. William S. Land, who I'm a big fan of, maintains it's World War One when second generation war came out. But there was an abandonment of the old column and line tactics, and the shift was towards firepower. And in this case, it was indirect artillery fire. But since then, pretty much most of the armed forces of the world have been focused on second-generation warfare because it still preserves to a great degree the culture of order that militaries and state organizations love to have. The third-generation warfare came about during World War One due to the Germans, and they started formulating it, I think, during 1917, and over there kind of the law and fighting during the winter of 1917 to 1918, they pulled many of their officers and senior NCOs out and taught them kind of a new way of thinking about fighting. And this came to be ultimately in World War II the basis of the Blitzkrieg. But in World War One, it was just a way that they envisioned to break the stalemate of trench warfare. And it succeeded very well in doing that, that when they launched their spring offensive in March of 1918, they overran the Allied lines in numerous places and were in a very good position to make progress. What ultimately doomed the Germans were a couple of things, is that it got to the point where the French were being able to use their own interior rail lines to shuttle support between various areas, as well as the incoming food imports from America, whereas in Germany they were facing starvation rations, and their initial form of Blitzkrieg was so successful that their supply lines became somewhat overextended that they didn't have the rail support. But it was very sound what they were doing. And in third generation warfare, it's called maneuver warfare. It's not focused on firepower and killing tons of people, but rather speed and surprise, mental as well as physical dislocation. And the idea is that you give people in the army an objective to take, but you don't tell them how to take it. You know, let them figure out how to do that. Let them advance as far as they can. And third generation warfare is not really, it's not a culture of order. It's more of a culture of results. But unfortunately, it takes people who are used to thinking for themselves to implement it. And there's very much a theological and cultural shift that has to take place for third-generation warfare to be accepted. There was an American colonel who was a fighter pilot that kind of created different variants on that. And you'll see it in people that write about, that do gun training and tactics sometimes. His name was John Boyd. And he didn't talk so much about the spatial view of maneuver warfare, that is, you know, in terms of space, but he was more in terms of time-based, where you kept an upbeat tempo, where you tried to keep your course of action so quick that your opponent could not react to you in time. So this was kind of a time element of maneuver warfare as well. And then the fourth generation warfare, which I'd already just mentioned, is non-state warfare, and it tends to be by its own nature to be more third generation because it's more guerrilla-based, and it requires people who think and are willing to take command and take action of their own. And that is not something you really see in second-generation forces. The police in America are very much a throwback to second-generation warfare, where they are focused more on order than they are on results. If people want to know more about this, I'd recommend them look at Colonel John Boyd on the Internet, Martin Van Creveld, William S. Lynn. Those are three names right there. Martin Van Creveld's book, The Rise and Decline of the State, goes in depth kind of to how fourth-generation warfare forces are winning pretty much anywhere where they're fighting at. And Creveld, I mean, he's not my favorite person in the world. He's a professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and you know, very much a Zionist in his outlook, but he has shown himself to be something of an unbiased scholar in a number of areas. He has some very nice things to say about the German Wehrmacht in World War II. So, yeah, he's not just your typical type of Jew that, you know, anytime he hears the word German, you know, he doesn't start screaming or anything like that. One book he wrote that was complimentary to the Germans, I think, was called Fighting Power, and it's something I want to read at some point. But, yeah, I'm going to get back to this subject of fourth generation and third generation forces here pretty quickly. But did you see a video that came out a couple of weeks ago? It was from the Metro Mall of Atlanta, and it was this black mall cop who was facing this woman who just kept sassing him, and he finally eventually tasered her, and she went down like a sack of potatoes. Did you see that?
I did see a tased woman, but I don't talk more about it. Maybe it'll come to me.
Well, there's actually a number of videos now. This man records everything he does for liability protection.
Oh, okay.
But he, it's in a part of downtown Atlanta that's overrun with black criminals, yeah. And he's trying to protect the stores in this Metro Mall. So he's always running blacks out or trying to get them even off the sidewalk. And, of course, they consider him an Uncle Tom. Thus far, people have set up a donation fund and put $20,000 in it to try to get him more money where he can, you know, fight, oh. You know, fight off the blacks. But, you know, he wears a bulletproof vest. Unfortunately, he can't carry a gun. But this is an excellent example to me of the efficiency of fourth-generation type warfare. And for once, it's not the criminal that's embracing the fourth-generation model. It's where this mall cop, where he's, you know, private security, and the results this guy is getting just by himself, it's amazing. I mean, he probably certainly deserves a pay raise, but he says that there is a police substation right around the corner from this place, but they never see the cops there at the Metro Mall. So here you have a man who's probably making $15 an hour, who's, you know, taking on the work probably of a number of policemen whose salaries are probably total up to be, you know, I don't know, 200,000, 400,000, half a million a year. I don't know.
Mickey Henry says his name is Darian Long, so do a Google search for Atlanta Metro Mall Cop Darian Long. Thanks, Mickey.
And the videos are fun to watch, too. I mean, because this black woman is just sassing him, and he gives her numerous instances, you know, time to back down. And he finally tases her, and boy, she just goes down like a, you know, like a bag of rocks. It is a riot to watch. But the man's life is very much in danger, and he needs a lot more help. He needs the ability to use deadly force. And, you know, what I would hope could be done is, you know, shut the police substation down, give that mall, give them about $100,000 of the police budget where they can hire more people and have deadly force. And I think they would have that problem cleared up in very short order. Another huge example of fourth generation, and when I say fourth generation criminal activity, I'm talking about non-state criminal activity. But in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, that you had all these looters that were, you know, scattered throughout the different parishes there. And they only could have been stopped by, I mean, you know, maybe several hundred armed people could have done it, but, you know, maybe it would have taken several thousand. And this is another advantage of using fourth-generation non-state forces to fight, because each individual property owner, he wants to protect his own property or probably at least his neighborhood he lives in. Whereas with the cops, you know, well, they're dispatched out of central places. They take a lot of time to arrive. There is no replacement for having a high number of people. But in Katrina, in the aftermath of Katrina, some of the worst looting went on by the Negro-infested New Orleans PD. Because unlike the average looter who probably was working, you know, walking on foot, the PD, the police department, they had their cars at their disposal. So if they wanted to steal a 60-inch color TV, hey, they could just throw it in the back and drive it out, you know, back to their house or some other place to pick up. So where you had, you know, non-state criminals and state criminals, second and fourth generation criminals that were, you know, basically destroying the city. And then to make matters really bad, the National Guard was sent in, which this would be, once again, a second-generation type mentality. And what did they do? Well, they disarmed law-abiding property owners. So you had, you know, these two terrible second-generation state-funded criminal factions that were doing the worst of the damage, and if people had been allowed to protect their own property, then the fourth-generation you know, black rioters and looters could have been handled very quickly. But it was the second-generation state forces that were creating, you know, such a bad problem.
That's a really good point.
The Maryland snipers, you remember them from
Yeah, I do.
Remember them back from 2002, I think it was, John Allen Muhammad and his buddy Lee Boyd Malvo.
Right.
You know, this was another instance of they were a fourth-generation force, obviously, and they were striking at random. And granted, this is kind of, you know, your society's worst nightmare, because if a sniper wants to set up shop, the only thing that stands between him killing you is basically an act of God. But if you had a highly armed populace, you hear shots, you go and investigate, then at least the man could have been limited in the number of people he killed. And, you know, that really wasn't their M.O. They would like to, you know, shoot one or two people, then they would go away. But if you had a high number of armed people around, there would have been a much higher chance they could have been stopped after the first or the second time that that they had, you know, set up and sniped at someone. And this is an aspect of fourth-generation forces, that typically they employ third-generation maneuver techniques, that they're not worried about drill and order. They're focused on results. And so you have the news release, news report that, oh, okay, we've got, you know, we've got a sniper that's hitting here in Prince George County. Okay, well, all of a sudden, posse goes on high alert, and everyone who carries armed is on high alert. They see some, you know, somebody that's walking along with a rifle. It looks suspicious. All of a sudden, you've got people all over it. They're not calling it in and doing the usual rigmarole that policemen do. And really, the only way, if those snipers had been a little bit more intelligent, I think they could have gone on killing for months. Unfortunately, they weren't intelligent. But the only way I think a sniper attack like that, or like the Zodiac Killer back in San Francisco in the early 70s, can be stopped fairly quickly is with a highly armed type populace. And by the way, you probably remember this, but Chief Charles Moose, who was in charge of the, I believe it was Montgomery County, Maryland, which was next to, I think, Prince George, Maryland, he knew the race of the snipers beforehand, but he wouldn't reveal it. And this is another example of law enforcement aiding criminals. In this instance, it was being done to, you know, to protect his own race, because Charles Moose was black. Terrorism, cartels, and mafia, or any sort of organized crime, another issue that has to be met when the threat materializes. If you have a couple of men that come into your store running a shakedown racket, the time to react is then, not to call up the police who would show up and the two men say, well, you know, we didn't do anything. I'm not sure where that man is coming from. It's his word against ours. That the in towns that have had the greatest presence of second-generation military or police forces, like, say, New York City, have also been the places with the highest degree of organized crime. And the only way to stop those kinds of forces, whether terrorists or cartels or mafia, is with the individual man and small neighborhood, small street-type posses to have dealt with the threat of organized crime. This cult of order, though, that exists in second-generation warfare, and unfortunately you see a lot of it in kind of the conservative movement in the United States. The middle class is up to its eyeballs in it, and I would say really even ultimately the Reformed church world is just, it's obsessed with order. And you see it, and sometimes it comes up to a really bad case, like with the old church that Gary North was with in Tyler, Texas, back in the 1980s, or more recently here, R.C. Sproul Jr.'s Ecclesiastical Tyranny in Bristol, Virginia. But the culture of order ultimately undermines itself, of where they're so focused on order that they become overly orderly, they become authoritarian, and then they implode. And, of course, the case with the Tyler Church of Gary North and R.C. Sproul's church, R.C. Sproul Jr.'s church, is I don't think either one exists anymore. Maybe R.C. Sproul's church does, but, you know, without him there as pastor. And this is something, I think this idolatry of order is something that we need to, like the small law, big law approach, is something that needs to be radically rethought out, that we need to be focused on righteousness and justice as a society. And that means, to some degree, I think, embracing a small degree of disorder in things, instead of wanting everything to be having processes and procedures to the nth degree. We need to be realizing sometimes the best reaction to crime is spontaneous reaction, not one that's orderly and planned out. I could say some more about John Boyd's views on things, but I think the point's pretty clear, though. Just a couple other things throwing out before we close out this section is on investigations, is that people will say, well, where they've watched too many of these shows that are police for forensic procedurals, and they think now, that you can't fight crime if you don't have a $10 million lab. Well, most small towns, police departments, they don't have that kind of forensic ability. And the only time, that they're going to call in a larger force, be the Texas Rangers or FBI or whoever, is going to be on a much larger case. Whereas if you go with more to the private investigation, I think that a lot of people, particularly in smaller towns, who are somewhat underserved from a lack of forensic ability, would probably have better access to that kind of detailed crime investigation than what exists now. That's all I was wanting to say about the forensic investigations. A lot of problems with traffic control is that there's unfortunately not really any way people have right now to blow off steam, that there's no place to go drag racing at, or they can't really drive fast. And something I've long thought would be a good idea, and particularly in smaller towns, this would be really easy to do, is to take over the local airstrip, say, on Saturday night, and open it up for drag racing. Or if you've got, say, an industrial area of town with some fairly long, straight streets, close them down Saturday night. No one's working there anyway, and allow people to go drag racing so they can get a lot of that reckless driving out of their system, but where they're doing it in a safe environment. Or in areas that have controlled access freeways in them, running through them, resort to Autobahn-type rules where there's an unlimited speed limit. They still need to drive in a way that's, hopefully won't get them killed, but or other people. But, in Germany, you've had this, basically unlimited speed limit on the Autobahn for decades, and yet it's not considered the death trap highway system of the world. So there's, an order there even, kind of a spontaneous social order that's formed. But America, obviously it hit its worst in the 70s when we adopted that 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, and it's improved somewhat now. I know there's parts of the country where you can drive 75, even up to 85 miles per hour. But there's the need to allow men to be to be bold and to do things like that, of driving their cars fast and or do drag racing. And I think if you had, this is part of the prevention issue I was talking about earlier, that if people had the ability to go drag racing or drive their cars very fast, I think you would see a lot less reckless driving on city streets during normal hours, a lot less red light running, a lot less speeding in dangerous areas. But even, it's not like we don't have a solution to that issue. Radar guns can be purchased by anyone, and this could be an extension of the posse that people, hopefully ones who drive a lot, that they would basically have radar guns. And you know, if you saw someone's driving recklessly, and that would be the bottom rule, would be, you know, reckless driving, not necessarily petty offenses, we could always, you know, shoot them with a radar gun and see how fast they're going, and then try to find a way to cite them. And the details to all that are not worked out in my head yet. I think that revenue collection is oftentimes a very bad idea, and I think sometimes maybe having someone who's a reckless driver, have them work off their penalty as being part of the, you know, volunteer road work crew would be a, you know, a better way. Or maybe if you had fines, have them being paid into a community pool where those funds are used to pay for private investigators would be a better way, instead of where no fines collected could go for the operational budget of a small sheriff's department, I think would be something to be, you know, throw about. But yeah, I think that pretty much concludes my comments on part four. And I realize the listeners are not looking at the outline, but is it okay to use, if we jump to the miscellaneous cop stuff, or do you want to?
I was going to say, I think you have too low a view of cops, Robert. They're pretty sacrificial heroes, aren't they? The most dangerous job out there.
Well, I mean, you got to admire at least their public relations work, that it has been nothing if but thorough on that front of, having people believe that. I've got a list that the 10 most dangerous jobs for 2011, commercial fishing was by far at the top, 121 deaths per 100,000 full-time workers in 2011. Then was loggers and related job titles to logging, 102 deaths out of 100,000. And then the number third position, I mean, it really drops off a lot from that. You're down to aircraft pilots and flight engineers, mainly, you know, smaller aircraft, at 57 deaths per 100,000. And then people that worked as garbage collectors, 41 deaths. Roofers were 32 deaths per 100,000. That's the number five position. And then it drops on down, structural iron, steel workers, farmers and ranchers, drivers, sales workers and truck drivers, electric power line installers, linemen, and then number 10 was taxi drivers and chauffeurs. And they were at 19.7 deaths per 100,000. So in the top 10 most dangerous jobs, you see a drop of 121 deaths per 100,000 to 19.7 deaths per 100,000. And, hey, that's too high even on the small end of things, but a huge reduction. And we still aren't even into the police listing at that point. And then you could probably further break that down. Okay, well, how many actual deaths in police work are from violent crimes and those that are caused because they drive too damn much? Well, you know, most police fatalities are. They are from driving fatalities.
That's true.
And, you know, just from them, you know, you drive 8 hours a day, your the statistical chances of you, you know, dying in an accident go up. Another kind of miscellaneous issue that I really couldn't find any good way to fit it in, so I'll just, you know, come out and say it under this category, is that organized sports seem to just breed red state fascism and, you know, the love of police and the military. And, you know, the NFL is just a foaming at the mouth pro-war faction. But almost all, you know, your hardcore type NFL types, or let me pick it up. I bet almost everyone who was mourning the death of Chris Kyle was a huge Dallas Cowboys fan. And, you know, you see too with the people that participate in sports where a lot of them are these just steroid-addled, steroid-enraged, super alpha male, weightlifting fanatics. And you see that also as well, particularly like in SWAT team type people. And I think one of the things, since men don't have the chance to be men via militias or posses, is that they turn to sports to try to prove their manhood. And, of course, as you get out of high school, you're not playing those sports anymore, so now you have to cheer for the sports team of your choice, and that's how you establish your manhood. And that is so pathetic that, it doesn't merit any further comment. But I think that if we start getting to a more responsible society with time, that you're going to see a drop-off in not only, obviously, the military and the police, but of a drop-off in organized sports fanaticism as well. Because the two are really linked at the hip, and it's something people should, have in the back of their mind if they're talking with people who are just, diehard football fans of some sort. Having said that,
I'm sorry,
why don't we... I know the hour is getting late, and we won't keep people much longer, but let's do finally launch into some military issues since, we've been promising this for three episodes of your show and have not yet delivered on that subject.
Well, let's do it. Let's talk about the Glory Boys.
There was a man on Facebook I recently had a disagreement with. He was a retired lieutenant colonel, and I gathered he was in one of the combat arms branches of the Army, and he's an oath keeper tard, so he believes that the military is full of fine patriots and everything. And most of what I'm going to repeat here comes from that argument I had with him, because I think I pretty much covered most of the big subjects with him. And one of my first points I would say in terms of, and the overall subject was, would the military fire on American civilians if ordered to, or would they participate in firearms confiscation or mandatory inoculation or something along those lines? My first point is that military bases are the most gun-restricted area in the entire U.S., that a few years ago it became required that every privately owned gun on base had to be registered with the base or the post police. And in fact, despite having secure storage, when I was in the Air Force, my dorm room, I had two closets with deadbolt locks on them. And, only I had the key as well as the dorm manager. I mean, I could have clearly kept a gun in there, but I had to keep my firearms at the security police armory. And this is a rule across the entire Department of Defense. So already you got soldiers there existing in the most gun-restricted area in the entire U.S. Concealed carry is not allowed at all on any military base except for those in the various investigative branches, such as the Navy's NCIS or the Air Force's Office of Special and Office of Special Investigation, or one of the Army or Marine Corps equivalent. Given those two issues, you could see how the troops might have a case of gun envy when it comes to people who are able to carry concealed. Or keep guns in their own houses. And if I were to kind of envision how a lot of them would probably think it out, they'd say, well, surely civilians should have the same rules and restrictions that I as a soldier have, since I'm guaranteeing all their freedoms. And, since most people like to have privileges that other people don't have, they would probably think that the civilians should have less gun rights than they do. And this is really manifested a lot of times by those who have like top secret level clearances, that they start developing this haughty mentality towards those who have lesser clearances or none at all. Another thing that comes up from, say, George Orwell's book, Animal Farm, that some animals are more equal than others. My second point I made to this man was the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that where were the mass resignations of officer commissions? Where was the mass drop in enlistments when this happened? It didn't happen, because open homosexuality really didn't bother the officer corps that much. And from what I've seen, probably not the most of enlisted people either. And I think they'll react the same way when told to march on American terrorists or insurgents. And to help matters further, the Fed Gov would probably strip gun owners in a really massive type insurrection of their citizenship anyway. And that way, soldiers and Marines could console themselves that, hey, I'm not firing on American citizens. They're not citizens anymore. Now, you add the to the don't ask, don't tell issue, the Department of Defense gave just this past month in January the green light to women entering combat arms branches. And thus far, I've seen nothing to suggest that there's been a mass resignation of commissions at all. So you're seeing these just heinous social engineering proposals go into the military with hardly a whimper being offered. But yet we're supposed to believe, you know, these oath keepers, who I think are really retarded in their reasoning, that, oh, well, they'll put up with all that, but then when it comes to guns, they're going to, you know, show this great constitutional consciousness. It's, per, you know, it's bizarre. It's not bizarre. It's moronic thinking. The third point, how many soldiers and Marines followed deployment orders, even if they believed the war in Iraq to be immoral? You had, like, you know, Pat Tillman. He believed the war was hopefully immoral, but he deployed and fought in it anyway. Why? Well, this goes back to the stuff we were talking about at the start of the show. Unfortunately, I'm not sure if this is true in every time or if it's just true now, but moral courage has never been a common virtue amongst the military class. And physical courage, yeah, you can find that, you know, fairly easily, but moral courage, non-existent. Point number four is pension time. That once you have someone that's past the 50% mark to earn a pension, and they would probably sell their own mother into slavery in order to collect it. And this just isn't a military problem either. You know, when J. Gresham Machen broke away from the PCUSA to start the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, he approached a number of PCUSA pastors, most of whom were, you know, older men, of, hey, you know, come join me. And in most instances, they said, we got too many years in with the PCUSA. You know, I need the pension. And I understand that. And that's more of me than an indictment of centralized retirement systems and pension plans. But where they stayed behind with the apostate PCUSA instead of, you know, helping Machen build something better. Point number five, the effects of groupthink and stupid ribbons and medals. You know, you have guys now. There was a man that I was in the Air Force with. You know, I was a radio and radar technician, nothing exciting. He stayed in, I think, for 23 or 24 years in that field. You look at him, and he looks like some sort of Mexican general. He's got so many ribbons on his chest. Seven rows. I mean, what did you give him for? Oh, because I pulled this vacuum tube at this time, or, you know, I fixed this radio, or I guarded a parking lot during an air show. But yet, you know, if you hold that little trinket out there to people, that a lot of them will do crazy immoral things to get more ribbons and medals. The Metallica, I heard you were playing Metallica at the start of the show, Battery, which is one of my favorite songs from the Master of Puppets album. But, you know, in the first song on side two, Disposable Heroes, that there's a great line there. James Hetfield sings, more a man, more stripes you bear, glory seeker trends. Yep. And, you know, it's, you could just slightly reshift that around. More a man, more ribbons and medals you wear.
Absolutely.
Your glory seeker trends. Another thing I need to remember, too, which I threw out in this man's face, was that, you know, one man's insurgent is another man's freedom fighter, but one man's freedom fighter is another man's insurgent. Point number six, 9/11 and terrorism, that after the Israeli and American attacks on the World Trade Center towers, the military wanted to flatten the Middle East with, you know, no investigation at all into that. And I'm going to combine this with another point, but that, you say, like the Sandy Hook shootings, or, you know, whatever actually happened there, we don't know. But the one thing that's certain is that the official story is not true. But if FedGov decided to pull off a fake Sandy Hook shooting every month for 3 months, I guarantee you the lion's share of military forces would be more than happy to shoot and imprison gun owners. And the point being with 9/11 is, hey, if FedGov was willing to conspire with Israel to bring down 200-story office towers and attack the Pentagon and to crash, you know, probably 4 aircraft, then what would be the, you know, pulling off 3 or 4 more Sandy Hooks would be nothing in comparison to that. And the people in the military are very susceptible to misinformation campaigns like that. into false flag operations. Point number seven is chaplains. That there are a bunch of apostates, and most of them are neo-Orthodox. There was a drive in the 1990s under Bill Clinton to basically clear out anyone who had even just a remnant of Orthodoxy. So, you know, you're going on now, 12 years after the end of the Clinton administration, and things have just gotten much worse of where the Romans 13 flag is going to get waved a lot, and probably even most of the chaplain corps probably doesn't even subscribe to, you know, the basic Orthodoxy of the creeds from Nicaea and Chalcedon. But they're certainly not going to pick a prime time to kill their careers and say, hey, no, we can't shoot against Americans. That's bad. The loss of shelter, money, and food, that's point number eight. In a time of insurrection, those three things may well come into short supply. Leave the military and you lose those things. Another point, number nine, is the low moral order of the armed force people, that fornication runs rampant, alcoholism is rampant, careerism, bootlicking, sycophancy. There are people that like to be told what to do, and that gives them, I think, to some degree, some encouragement in their low moral character. But you're not going to find people who work side by side with homosexuals and who have women in combat arms branches and who are fornicators and alcoholics say all of a sudden, hey, it may be immoral to fire on American people. No, I mean, these are people that are dedicated to immoral activity. Point number 10 is that National Guardsmen have already disarmed white Americans in the aftermath of Katrina. So this has already been done once. We know how it went down. And things have only gotten worse in the 7.5 years since then. Number 11 was back in around 1994-1995, Soldier of Fortune magazine ran an article. It was an original article, not a reprint, of how Marines would have reacted if given the order to fire upon Americans and collect their weapons. The surveyed results were not really encouraging, but what really discourages me now is that survey is nearly 20 years in the past, and people in the military have decayed by a lot. The 12th point to make was that, I combined that with another point. Okay, new point number 12. Posse Comitatus Act, passed in 1877, said that the military could not be used against civilians. Well, that went out the door in 1993 with the Branch Davidian standoff in Waco, yeah, where we had not only the tank that was crashing into the Davidian compound, but also you had elements of Delta Force that were there, not only as a technical advisory role, but according to a senior NCO who was with the 7th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, who published a publication called The Resistor, that there were Delta Force snipers that were also at the Davidian compound that were shooting the people there. So, you know, Posse Comitatus is dead and buried. It's not going to stop the federal government from using the military if they need to. And the last massive point I brought up on that listing was about what's been going on in Iraq since 2003 was that, well, the soldiers and Marines and sailors, predominantly the SEALs, have been involved with disarming the Iraqi people who have done nothing to us.
How did your friend justify that?
Pardon?
How did your friend justify that, the Iraq war?
He did it by defriending me and blocking me.
Oh, okay.
You know, he's an oath keeper retard, so he didn't really have anything to say. That's a problem with so many people like that. They don't really have anything to say back to you when it comes to when you've got hard
or even
arguments.
Even when they disagree with the war, they'll say, well, we should disagree with the war, but support the troops.
Yeah, kind of like that whole hate the sin but not the sinner insanity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, they're participating in an immoral war, so how can I separate the troops from the war, just like the sin and the sinner? How can I separate the two?
Yeah, the U.S. military has been doing this for years. They knew what they were getting into, and they signed up for it.
Sure, and certainly the senior officers do, and yet, but they're careers, and so they're going to stick around. You know, they want those fancy ribbons, and they're all hoping to retire and go to work for a defense contractor as a lobbyist, where they can make, you know, seven-figure salaries. And there's more I can say on that subject, but I'm noticing the clock right now, and we've gone for nearly 2 hours. Is there any questions people fired out there that you think we ought to look at before wrapping things up?
I don't see any questions in the chat room. There's some comments, and Eric says that he was going through 3 months of law enforcement training, and not once did he hear the Constitution mentioned, which is odd.
It's kind of nice to have that confirmation, though, from another party, though.
Yeah. And it's good to know that people in the chat room have some experience with so-called law enforcement, and they're here listening to this.
Well, plus your own experience where you were screened out early on.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure which show we talked about that. Either people can go back to your previous two podcasts and hear about how I was. They drummed up some charges. I guess I failed the lie detector test because I think the question was, have you ever transported drugs illegally? And they didn't like my body science during that question, so I think it was a way of getting me out of there because of the psychological profile I took didn't reveal myself to be a order taking non-original thinker. But anyhow,
well, they certainly wouldn't want people like you among them. And,
Well, do you want to use the last 4 minutes to say anything, to wrap up any loose ends? Because we've done, this is our third show, and I see there's still some material you wanted to cover. Anything pressing that our viewers and listeners need to hear about law enforcement and military?
Maybe at some point in the future, we might warrant a separate talk some months from now, but on the subject of intelligence, that I think the threat of domestic intelligence is one that's enormous, that you know, domestic intelligence, separate from what, say, the FBI does with its counter-terrorist or its counterintelligence division, where you have these fusion centers that have popped up, and most of them have been absorbed into the Department of Homeland Security, and now they are. I think there's some degree of FBI oversight, but where they are. They disseminate information to local law enforcement, and these fusion centers, unfortunately, are highly allied with the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center and other Jewish and liberal-dominated organizations that they really don't want to hear anything from right-wing sources. And so these fusion centers are pointing local law enforcement in the direction that they want them to hear. And unfortunately, they're all connected at the hip once again, the Department of Homeland Security, with Jew Michael Chertoff being its first secretary, and its penchant for handing out grants and loans and business contracts to Jewish organizations, and then their tie-in with the fusion centers and their desire to take information from domestic Jewish information sources. And that's it's a huge problem that's going to eventually have to be dealt with. And one other last point would be probably the drones. You know, I think of the Star Wars, you know, the Attack of the Clones and the Clone Wars. Well, increasingly, it looks like we're facing something like that here domestically, of the attack of the drones and the drone wars. Of law enforcement is just dying to get its hands a hold of drones. And if things do not change, I mean, I could literally see the day coming where there are probably at least 1,000 operations of drones a day used for, at first, they'll be used for intelligence gathering, predominantly, you know, optical in nature or using synthetic aperture radar. Let's just say imaging intelligence. But eventually, law enforcement will push to have probably the ability to launch Hellfire missiles from their drones. If they don't want to endanger one of their sweet SWAT teams, that they'll say, well, this is a known drug house. Let's launch a Hellfire missile into it.
Yeah.
And the law enforcement's just dying to get its hands a hold of drones. So those are two big things to watch in the future.
How do you
see? There's a lot of other things we could say on the topic, but, I mean, to me, that gets the worst of it right there. you know, that covers a lot of the worst aspects of the topic.
I know we can't. I know you got. I know you can't predict the future. But what do you? How do you see this working out? We obviously the DHS and the feds are gearing up for what appears to be at least riots, if not a civil war. How do we win that battle if it happens?
We're kind of, I would say, probably about where the Russians were at in around May of 1917, where they'd had their first minor revolution, installed their Kerensky government, and then the Bolshevik Revolution was waiting. How will it pan out from there? And some things I probably shouldn't talk about like that, but I mean, God willing, the bad people will not win, whatever's coming on that front. The hour is really late with how far along we are. And, what happened in Russia very quickly. With us, it's been a slow, gradual cooking session, and so we have a lot less excuse than what the Russian people had. But, yeah, I would say that, to me, I don't think Obama's the essence of all evil. We've been coming at this for a long time. But he is a terrible person, and I think there has been something of a break with even the evil of the Bush years, that the blacks, in particular the black crime, just seems to have skyrocketed since 2008. And I think, black people in particular are very much less responsible even as rulers, even compared to the likes of, say, George W. Bush. So will they, are they looking for an opportunity to declare war on us? Well, the purchase of, a billion plus rounds or however many it is now from the Department of Homeland Security certainly seems to suggest that, and that's certainly the most likely and simple explanation. So that's where I think they're going, is to eventually probably try to kill off all political opposition to the regime, and it'll be done with under false flag movements and classifying people as terrorists. And the law enforcement community seems to have already pretty much bought into that completely. I don't really think these sheriffs that are saying that they support the Second Amendment, that to me it's, I mean, I'm glad to hear them say it, but I don't really think that'll be any, it won't figure in any sort of positive way that, what I would like to hear is a sheriff saying that, hey, I will block the efforts of different law enforcement agencies to do that in my county. Now, that would carry some weight. But to just say, well, I won't enforce that, okay, well, fine, someone else will. What are you going to do about that?
Yeah, I don't think these guys are going to do anything. You hear about some small town and small county sheriffs, but where are the big cities?
That's where
the fire is going to rage. I think Phoenix, there was a sheriff there that said something, but I want to find out what are the big city cops going to do. And it sounds like, from what I hear, they're not going to do anything.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And what would happen probably is if some force came in to, do gun control or mandatory vaccines or whatever, if citizens arrested them, I think the cops would come into the rescue to help rescue their brothers in blue and, to support the badge. And they would say, well, the resistance struck back too hard and struck back too early. We still have to go through the courts and all like that. So they'll have some way of justifying it in their mind, as, the unbeliever always does. He had his right to his own sin. So we're seeing a culmination of failures of centuries of failures of Protestantism to deal with these sorts of substantial major issues. And long term, I think you're going to see a third wave, kind of a new third age of Christianity emerging out of this, where Luther drove a stake through the heart of the Roman Catholic Church, and they never recovered from it. And Eastern Orthodoxy has been pretty much irrelevant any time a major foe faces it, whether it be Islam or Bolshevism. And Protestantism has been cutting its throat for the last two centuries by supporting statism. And I think it's time again. It's been 500 years since Luther and Calvin did their thing, and we really need kind of a new Christian movement, which will in part embrace kenism and theonomy and postmillennialism, because those ideas, I mean, let's face it, there's been almost zero interest in them from even the Reformed Church, let alone from the Baptist or the Evangelicals. The Evangelicals are just about probably the worst theological community in the United States today. So,
well, Robert, thank God we have guys leading the way, like John Piper, who says that we should not want to kill someone who's trying to kill us because we might send them to hell. And why would you want to do that?
Well, he's one of these great new Calvinistic Baptists who still reasons like an Arminian, you know.
Yeah, what an idiot.
And you just wonder how many people that are calling themselves Calvinists today are really Calvinists and aren't just Arminians that, you know, say, oh, well, God is sovereign, but let me just tack that onto my Arminian theology instead of saying, oh, God is sovereign. Oh, crap, I got to reformulate my whole theology.
Yeah, that was pathetic to hear that. Well, I think we'll wrap up. You agree?
I think so. We made it over the two-hour mark.
We did. I do want to thank you again for coming on. I know it's a lot of hard work and preparation, so thanks so much, Robert.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thanks for all the people who listened and who stuck with us for 2 hours and who are in the chat room. We'll do another show next week with Matt Parrott. Will be here to help me, and we'll talk about some current events. So stay tuned for that. And again, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.